And ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith will be talking about the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca called the Hajj. I want to welcome today Imad and Fatima Jazm, husband and wife, and Umar Irfan, a student, sophomore, is that right, here at the University of Illinois?
Yes.
What are you studying, Irfan?
I'm studying biochemistry.
And how did you pick that? Was that something you were interested in as a high school student? Or
somewhat.
And do you have any people in your family who do that kind of science, or is this something new?
It's something new in our family.
I see. Now, you're from a local family.
Yes.
It's here in Champaign-Urbana. What do your parents do?
My father works for the University of Illinois and in the Department of Engineering. And basically, he is my link to the university administration.
Very good. Did you have a choice of whether you could go to another college, or was this the only one?
This was the best choice.
Yeah. And let's see, we have two other graduates of the university here. Imad, when were you here as a student?
I was here as a student starting in 1996, and then I had gone all the way to my master's in mechanical engineering, went to work, came back to do my PhD where I am right now.
And what are you studying now?
It's in mechanical engineering.
Mechanical engineering. And Fatima, you're a graduate too.
I just completed my master's in nutrition.
As well as having a child.
Yes.
You have a five-year-old now.
Yes.
A five-month-old.
A five-month-old, Yusuf, yes.
And so you were pregnant when you went on the Hajj a year ago.
That's true. We found out we had already made all the travel arrangements. And I think 2 weeks before we were scheduled to fly, we found out that I was pregnant. We contemplated canceling the trip, but we were just so excited. And we asked the doctor, and she said that as long as we take precautions, it should be fine.
Sure.
So we decided to go.
And we want to learn about your experience. But first, let's just get a general picture for listeners who may not know about what the Hajj is. Tell us. Imad, can we start with you?
Okay. Hajj is one of the five pillars of Islam. And everybody must perform Hajj, who is Muslim, sometime during their lifetime, if they can afford it. And that's a big if, because
sure,
a lot of the world actually cannot afford it. And it's a pilgrimage to Mecca, where there was the first mosque believed to be built in Islam, was built. It's called the Kaaba, and this is the direction which all Muslims pray towards. And Hajj is also a time where we follow the different steps that Abraham has followed, and also his family, Hagar. And then also Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, followed then the same steps. So that's essentially, in a nutshell, what Hajj is.
Now, you say this is one of the five pillars of Islam. What's a pillar?
A pillar is one of the main components in Islam that we all must believe in and must conform to.
Now, to be Muslim is fairly simple. I've had some of the scholars tell me that it's maybe the simplest of things for the various world religions. You simply must affirm that there's one God, Allah, and Allah is just the name for God, that Allah's prophet is Muhammad. And yet these five pillars are highly, would you say, highly encouraged? I mean, you can be a Muslim without doing any of them, right? Because you could just affirm that first statement.
It's true. But the interesting thing about this statement is that it's not just an affirmation of faith. You are defined by your actions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you believe in this, you are responsible to carry out certain actions, such as You can utter this statement, but you cannot do harm to people.
Mm-hmm.
There's responsibilities that come by uttering the statement. And if you have true belief in God, then you're responsible to carry out certain actions. And the five pillars are the most basic of those duties that all Muslims are encouraged to do. There are so many other things. You know, the five pillars, one of the pillars is not that you should be good to people, but that's something that is a basic tenet of the Islamic faith.
Umair, when you went, you were fairly young. You went in 99.
Yes.
So you would have been how old then?
I believe I was 13.
And did your whole family go at that point?
Yes, we did. We all went together.
And who all was included in that group?
It was me, my younger sister, my father, and my mother, all traveling together.
I see. And how old was your sister?
She was 3 years younger than me, so I believe she was 10.
10. Now, does that count if you go when you're 10, or do you have to make an adult decision to go on the Hajj?
I mean, if you understand what's going on, that's the idea behind the Hajj is that you are fully aware of what you're doing and that basically that it has to have a certain kind of impact on you. And I mean, I don't want to go as far as to say that it didn't count, but I'm sure you probably were still rewarded for it if you do it at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that it's better to perform it when you're a fully capable, fully functioning adult. That way you're doing it of your own means. You're not dependent on anybody else and mm-hmm. that you are doing it out of your own faith. Because, I mean, maybe as a younger child, you may not grasp the full extent or the full impact of what it is that you're doing. So I guess I don't know. That's why I was having an argument with my parents about this, whether or not it counted, because I mean, they said you're right on the verge, you're borderline.
Sure.
You're almost mature, but not quite or something like that. So it's basically I would like to perform it again.
Would you?
Personally, because uh-huh. I don't think I got the full grasp of it at that point.
Uh-huh.
So.
But what were some of your impressions? Now it's been how 6 years?
Yes.
You've matured. You're in college. You're studying science. As you look back on it, what impressions have lasted?
I mean, you really don't find that many people gathered in one place to do just one thing, and that was just the surprising part. It's not like you can – I mean, even in like going to like a football game here or something like that.
80,000.
You have many people, but not everybody around you is doing the same thing. Not everybody's
sure.
interested. But there – everybody sees you and everybody knows what you're here to do.
Uh-huh.
Everybody's there is trying to help you to do the same thing as well. And one of the unique things about Hajj is that the way – I mean, one thing especially that struck me was the way that everybody's required to dress.
Hmm.
And that's for men, it's considered – it's just two unstitched garments. And the idea behind that is that you're equal in front of the eyes of God, and this is just a tangible way of showing it, that it's not your clothes that defines you. It's not your wealth that defines you. It's basically your actions that define you in this context. And so that's what really struck with me was that you can go there and everybody looks the same.
Mm.
It doesn't matter who's old or who's young or who's rich or who's poor. It's everybody is common. Everybody is the same.
And let's talk about how many people were there. Now, I know it changes from year to year. Ahmad, when you went, how many were – what was the official number?
I think the official number was somewhere between like 2 and 3 million people.
Goodness.
But I think the unofficial number is maybe closer to 5 or 6 million is what I've been told and what it really looks like. So
So it's just in comparison with what most people have seen, even at a huge – athletic event or something. I guess those would be some of the largest things we've seen in this country of maybe 100,000. This is just so much more. Amazing. So what are the problems with being in a group of 2 million people who are all doing the same thing, going the same? How far is – what's the distance? Let's talk about how many days does it take? What are some of the facts here?
Hajj itself is not that many days. It starts on the 8th of Dhul Hijjah, which is essentially the 8th of January now, which is the Islamic lunar calendar, which Hajj occurs from. And then it goes to the 13th of Dhul Hijjah. And so it's fairly short. The distances traveled are not that long, but a lot of them are on foot. So then it becomes a lot longer.
So not all of it is done on foot. I thought somehow it all was. It's not
some
necessary.
People do okay. it all on foot.
Some do.
But some people don't. The total distance is no longer than maybe 6 or 7 miles that you actually have to travel during the entire time of Hajj. in a one shot. Then
over the 6 days?
No, over the 6 days, it could be quite a bit more than that.
Of course.
But yeah, yes.
But each day of the 6 days, it would be 5 or 6 miles, is that what you're saying?
No more than that, yeah.
Okay. And when these 2 million people or more are gathered over this week, traveling together in simple garments, what do they take with them to sustain themselves?
Water.
Yes.
Water is primary. Although food and water are readily available, there are shops found throughout. The city of Mecca itself is where the Kaaba is located, so most of the action happens there. Now, in Hajj specifically, you travel to a small village outside of Mecca. I'm not sure how many miles out of Mecca it is. There, it's basically a tent city, which comes up during the time of Hajj, and 3 days later, it's nowhere to be found. Mm. So people take food, water with them. You can buy food and water there. And most of the travel is with groups, so the group leaders provide the food for the members also.
There's a lot of donations that people give, or there's a big spirit of giving to the Hajjis. You'll find that some people have made prepared packages, like box lunches, to give to them. And almost every Hajji will get maybe 4 or 5 of them during the time, and it contains juice and whatever. So there's a big spirit of giving, not just that, but in people just opening the door to their SUV and bringing out trays of rice, you know, stuff like that. I mean, so it's a very generous time for people there.
So do people need to take money to buy things, or is everything given to people who are on the pilgrimage?
Yeah, they have to take money. For the most part, some of them will actually make their money there. Some people can only afford the ticket over there, and that's it. And so in order for them to eat, they have to actually sell goods to the people that are going on Hajj.
I see. Interesting. So when you're on this walk, this march, this pilgrimage, what do you do? I mean, do you sing? Do you chant? Do you pray? Do you what happens?
Well, as Hajjis, which Hajji is the term for a person who is performing or has performed Hajj, there is a certain Arabic chant that is performed while you are performing Hajj. Most of the time, though, people are, they are mentioning the name of God, they can be reciting verses of the Quran, they can be performing worship, or they can simply be commenting on the environment. So it depends on the person, I think.
What does a 13-year-old do?
I mean, the chanting was was a lot of fun to do, because you had the whole bus like chanting the same thing, and so that was kind of a good thing to get your spirits up. And so the chant that Fatima was referring to is the one basically thing you will always hear when you're going on Hajj. Lots of different groups will be saying it, and roughly it translates to "Here we come, God. Here we come to serve you. And here we come, no partner do you have, all praise is yours, the universe is yours, so here we come."
Could you give it to me in Arabic?
It's labbaik allahumma labbaik, labbaik allah sharika laka labbaik, innal hamda wa ni'mata laka wal mulk la sharika lak. And so that's what you can, I mean, they start like a whole refrain, like the whole call and response. So you have one person leading and everybody else is following along with that chant. And that's very uplifting when you hear that.
And what's interesting about this is that 2 million people, they're all from various parts of the world. So it's very hard to find a person who speaks the same language as you.
Sure.
So it was so amazing to find that you do not speak the same language, but in this Arabic, this refrain that Omer mentioned is just repeated throughout. So this served as a unifying aspect among all the people who were there from different parts.
Huh. What were the youngest children you saw there?
I saw women who were carrying babies that might have been 5 or 6 months.
Really?
Yes, they looked very comfortable on their mother's back or in their arms.
Particularly from the African countries, you know. Mm-hmm. They're used to that more than we are. You know,
take children everywhere.
Yeah,
sure. We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with three guests, all of whom have been on the Hajj, the pilgrimage that Muslims take at this time of year. When will it start this year?
It'll start now, January 8th, which is the 8th of Dhul Hijjah.
I'd like to encourage listeners to give us a call if you have a question or comment. This is a live program here on WILL AM 580 each Sunday from 5 to 6. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. And if you'd like to call, the number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere the program is heard outside of Champaign-Urbana, you may use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call for you, do use the 800 number. That's 222-WILL. And that includes, of course, listeners on the Internet. We do have a caller I see already on line one, one of our local lines. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just heard a BBC explainer last night in the middle of the night about the Hajj, and I was struck by the fact that that the procession going up and down the hills and some of the things are based on the Abraham's wife, I forget how to pronounce her name, trying to...
Hagar.
Trying to bring succor and water to a sick child. I guess Abraham was absent, and that it's based on that. And I'd never heard anything like that before. I'm just curious about that and what kind of significance that has, or maybe it's been lost in time. And I don't know. I also hear a lot about fundamentalist preachers railing against Ishmael, and I don't know the substance of that. I don't know if...
By fundamentalist preachers, you're referring to Christian fundamentalists. Robertson,
actually, in several days after calling for the head of Chavez, said something supposedly equally controversial in some circles about, you know, the bad seed aspect of Ishmael, and I don't know how to characterize it further than that. I'll just hang up and listen and see how you react to that. Thank you.
Thank you. So the question is about some of the stories about Abraham and his wife Hagar and their child. Who wants to talk about that a bit?
Okay. We believe that was Ishmael, that Hagar was trying to get food and water to, because he was crying. Essentially, Abraham had just left them in the desert because he was ordered by God to leave them there, and she agreed to it. She essentially asked, is this guidance from God? And he said, yes. And so she agreed to it, and she said, okay, we'll stay here. And then she went between two hills called Safa and Marwa, and these are two hills that we go to, and we'll walk between and pray while we walk between those two hills. And at times we even start running as she had run. And then after that, what had happened is Ishmael was kicking in the sand, and then there was a spring that came up, and this spring is called Zumzum. And this is there even to today, and it never dries out, and it feeds, it gives water to all of the Hajjis. So millions of people every year drink from this water. And then this is how Mecca was able to be established, because there was really nothing there before then. And we believe that all prophets are good, and this is one of the characteristics of a prophet, is that they're all good. So from our standpoint, whether it be Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, whether it be Muhammad, or whether it be Jesus, may peace be upon them all, we believe they're all good. So.
Since the caller raised the issue, let me raise a question some of our listeners may have, which is the difference between the stories about Abraham in the Quran, which you've just been recounting, describe his wife Hagar and Ishmael, her son, and the stories in the Jewish Tanakh, the stories in Genesis from the Bible. they referred to Abraham and his two wives, Sarah and Hagar, but tell slightly different stories. How do modern educated Muslims think about that? And when they, okay, here's what our tradition says, here's what the Quran says, here's what Genesis says in the Bible that Jews and Christians also consider scripture. What do you as modern graduate students, undergraduate students at a university, how do you deal with these differences?
Just like we would deal with any of the other differences that exist between the faiths, we accept them as differences that exist and we just leave it at that. We do not make any judgment on whether this is the right way or the wrong way because we know that differences exist and we know that stories are related differently among different traditions. So this is the version that has come down to us and there may be a different version that other people believe in.
Mm-hmm. But how do you, as scientists, I mean, here you are studying science, how do you turn off your scientific skepticism when you read stories in your tradition? I ask the same question to Christians, of course. You're in biochemistry, Umair. You want to deal with that?
The thing is, we're told as Muslims that one thing you should not do, never stop doing is questioning things.
Ah.
And so you don't really turn off the idea of skepticism. You consider it. I mean, you should view things skeptically and make sure, see if they make sense. But also there's the aspect of faith that you believe that there's a God and that he's thoroughly capable of intervening in any events. And so like one of the key differences in the story between what – and the Judeo-Christian tradition and the Muslim traditions about Abraham is that we believe that it was Ishmael that was sacrificed before God at the command of God. And not Isaac, which I believe the Jews and Christians believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the message behind that was basically that Abraham was told to do this by God. And he was told to sacrifice the thing he loves most. And he did this unquestioningly. And even though he was a little bit scared of doing it, he did it. And he was rewarded by God for his faith. And he didn't end up sacrificing his son. He sacrificed a lamb instead. And the difference between whether it's Isaac or Ishmael, it's subtle. And quite frankly, I don't really see what difference it makes in the terms of the story. The point of the story is that Abraham was able to show that his love of God far exceeds anything in this world and that God loves him just as much and wouldn't and rewarded him for his love of God and his faith. And so the point is that he was willing to give up something, a child that he had, and something that he would consider extremely valuable to himself, something you can't put in any tangible terms, and give that up for God.
One of the ways that story is off, it's a very difficult story, of course, in all three of those religions you refer to, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, one of the ways it's sometimes interpreted in Christianity and Judaism is that it was the statement that meant the end of child sacrifice. Back in those times, 3,000 years ago or so, whenever it was, apparently, historians say that there was child sacrifice being done in a lot of religions. But in Judaism after that time and in Christianity after it developed out of Judaism and in Islam, child sacrifice is forbidden. And it may go back to that story. And yet we see in the news even last week sometimes horrible things happen to children in the guise of religion. How do Muslims react when those things happen?
It's a terrible thing when it happens. But we believe from the beginning of time, from Adam, that it was wrong to do that, and God asked him to do that, knowing that he would not make him do that.
Mm-hmm.
And no one will be asked to do that. And when people do that, it's a heinous crime, in any shape, you know, or form. I mean, any time you hear it, it's wrong. And it happened after also Abraham, in many of the other religions that existed throughout the world, and actually in Arabia, that happened before Muhammad, may peace be upon him, came and preached and said that, you know, this is in fact wrong. People would even bury their own daughters alive before he started preaching the message. So
we're talking with Ahmad Jazm, who was just speaking, and his spouse Fatima, and with a sophomore at the university, Umer Irfan, about the Hajj, the pilgrimage that Muslims will be taking beginning January 8 for a week, 6 days, I guess, to be exact, again this year. If you have questions, do give us a call. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, 333-WILL. If you're listening where that would be a long-distance call, do use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. When you were 2 months pregnant and took the pilgrimage last year, Fatima, you said your doctor here said that she thought it would be fine. And did you talk with other women who may have let you know they also were pregnant during that time?
I did. One of my friend's mother went when she was 7 months pregnant, and she said that was very hard. And so most of the women I spoke with recommended that after the first trimester, maybe you shouldn't go, just because at that time I felt fine. I didn't have morning sickness. I didn't have any of the complications that come early in the pregnancy.
You were lucky, yeah.
Yes, I was lucky. The only problem I had was that I was so hungry.
Ah.
So wherever I went, I always had to make sure I had a supply of food with me.
Sure.
So, but, you know, the women that I spoke with said that as long as I take care of my health, make sure that I don't exhaust myself, I should be fine. And I found that to be true.
In Western cultures, in the United States particularly, I think many women would be very nervous about going to a huge gathering like that because there's often violence against women. How do women on the Hajj feel?
I think because the intention of Hajj is to perform worship, there's not that much fear of harassment or molestation just because you are going to perform a pilgrimage. It's a sacred time, and people who are performing it are in a sacred mode also. Another thing I think that deters people is that you are at the Kaaba. The Kaaba is a black building that is used as a cornerstone or the direction of where people turn to pray. So that is a reminder to people that you are here to worship. Be mindful of your manners.
How are women dressed?
You know, Umer mentioned that men wear the white garments. Women are dressed beautifully. They represent all the cultures that they come from. So there's vibrant colors. There's different styles. There's the Malaysian who wear gorgeous flowers. And there's Africans who have African print. And then, you know, there's Americans who wear pants. There's Turkish women who wear, you know, Turkish-style outfits. And so there's a huge array of different types of clothes that people wear. And whereas the men, you see a sea of white, and then you see vibrant colors that the women are wearing. And so it's really remarkable to see that.
Would all of the women or most of the women be wearing head coverings as well?
Definitely. Head covering is a requirement because to be able to perform the pilgrimage, you have to be in a clean state of mind and body and clothes. So there's a requirement of covering.
Mm-hmm. And in the women's dress, there's more possibility of showing wealth. Would you wear jewelry?
You are allowed to wear jewelry, but it's recommended that you not wear as much.
Okay. What is the percentage of women who do the Hajj compared to men?
I would say maybe 40%. I found that there were as many women as there were men, maybe a little bit less.
Okay, interesting. We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program on this Sunday, January 1st. And I want to thank our guests for being with us today. And we'll be continuing to talk about the Hajj and their experience with the Hajj as we go into the second half of the program. Let me take just a moment to let listeners know what's coming up in the weeks ahead on this weekly program. Next week, we'll be talking with Reverend Brian Sieber about Japanese Pure Land Buddhism. That's on January 8th, again from 5 to 6 p.m. here on AM 580, WILL, a radio service of the College of Communication here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Later on in January, we'll be hearing again about Islam. We'll also be hearing about Judaism in February, and we have several other interesting guests are already scheduled for later in the spring. So I encourage listeners to write down our telephone numbers and do give us a call during those shows if you have a question or a comment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the executive director for the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois, which is the oldest religious institution at the university. It was begun here in 1873 by students, and since that time has been providing opportunities for social action and community service, as well as providing chances for reflection on important issues of our time. Some of the programs at the Y include Friday Forum, a noon discussion, lecture and discussion event that's been going on for almost 80 years on this campus at the University Y. We also have Know Your University, which allows different parts of the University of Illinois to talk about what they're learning and teaching and doing, so that other parts of this big university can learn about them. That's on Tuesday noons at the Y, and that'll be starting up in February. We have, at this time of the year, also CommUniversity will be beginning soon when classes start again. And this is an opportunity for people to take classes that they're interested in that they get no credit. It's not a credit course at the university, but it might be something fun. You might want to learn to knit. You might want to learn a foreign language, how to repair your car, how to do social dancing. Aurora Villacorta has been teaching dance classes at the University of Hawaii for over 25 years and continues to offer those classes. So watch for the catalog when it comes out in 2 or 3 weeks and sign up for a class and learn something that you might just enjoy doing. Karate, photography, all kinds of things will be at the University of Hawaii. We don't have a gym. We don't have a fitness center. We don't have a pool, but we have many opportunities for learning and for service. If you have questions about any of the Y events, do call me, Steve Shoemaker, at 337-1500 during the week. If you enjoy this program, you might also enjoy Religion and Ethics News Weekly. That's on our sister television station, WILL-TV, Sundays from 12:30 to 1. Host Bob Abernathy provides in-depth coverage of the top religion and ethics stories in the news. That's on WILL Television, Sundays at 12:30. Well, getting back with our guests here in the studio, we're very happy to have a married couple, Imad and Fatima Jazim, and a college student, sophomore in biochemistry, Umair Irfan, today with us. Let's talk a little bit about the spirituality of the Hajj. What do you come away with now that you've made this pilgrimage? You're encouraged to do it, expected to do it if you can afford it once in your lifetime. You've each done that. What do you still have from that experience?
Essentially, it's training for life. That's what Hajj is, and I see it as a test of your patience. You have so many people at one place and one time. It tests your patience. At the same time, you appreciate what you have because there's always someone who has less. And you will see people who have less who are sometimes sleeping on the streets because they have nowhere else to go. And you see that, and you also get to meet people from all over the world, literally all over the world. Every time you go to pray, one of your times of the day during the five prayers, you normally end up sitting next to another person from somewhere totally foreign to you, and you may make signs or whatever to try to communicate, and that's important. So it should improve you as a person, and if we perform it correctly, if we are behave in a good way during the entire Hajj, and then we believe that all of our sins will be forgiven. So that's a very good incentive for us to go to Hajj. Yeah.
You mentioned the five prayers of the day. Muslims who are being faithful do that regardless of where they are as they're traveling. How do you fit that in a school schedule, Umair?
For the most part, there's a range of time you can pray them, not exact single point. So usually I can pray between classes. There's always enough time. It's never really been an issue. The Muslim Students Association has a cubicle at the Illini Union. So between classes, if anybody needs to pray, you can go up there and pray. And the mosque is also just off campus, so that's also not too far off. So it's never really been a problem in terms of actually finding a place and time to pray.
Now, people who've accepted the invitation of CIMIC, the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center here on Lincoln Avenue, to come and witness the daily prayer time, you have an open invitation that non-Muslims are welcome to come to observe, to learn. Have seen how for those prayer times when people gather, people kneel, they say part of the prayer standing, part of them kneeling, part of them with their heads on the floor. What happens on the Hajj? How do millions of people pray together?
In the Hajj, it's performed in the exact same manner too, and this goes along with the universality that Umair mentioned at the start of the program. There's literally everybody doing the same movement as you are. We don't speak the same language, we don't look alike, we don't even dress alike, but we are performing in the exact same manner, uttering the exact same words in the prayer. So there's a real connection that forms with other people in the Hajj.
Now, who's in charge? I mean, Islam doesn't have clergy, doesn't have bishops and archbishops and popes and things like that. Who runs the Hajj? Who organizes it? Who makes sure people have enough food, have places to stay, have bathrooms accessible?
The logistics, for the most part, are handled by the Saudi government. They basically handle the influx of immigrants and people coming in on Hajj visas. They also regulate how people are going everywhere. And so when you're making a Hajj, there's also very stringent travel requirements. You're not really allowed to go anywhere else. And so they try to make everybody under their control for that period of time. And that's understandable given that you have 2 million people that need to move from point A to point B in a short period of time and then back. And so it's logistically, that's who handles it. But in terms of people of like performing the rituals, most people are it's understood that most people should get acquainted with what's going on beforehand. And so everybody knows where they're supposed to be or where they should be going. And you can usually just follow the crowd of people. There's always a big crowd going wherever it is that you need to be going. And so you probably won't get lost there very easily. But in terms of just the actual logistics, that's mostly the Saudi government. But in terms of what people are doing, that's really up to the individual.
Since you've mentioned governments and how they're involved, at least in being supportive in some ways, at least in terms of the Saudis, what about differences of political opinions? After all, there are different sects within Islam. There are certainly different politics. Is there ever a worry about terrorism on the Hajj?
I believe there was an incident a few years back in the actual mosque, and so they basically beefed up their security around the area. For the most part, they have guards at every door, and they don't allow you to carry bags in there and things like that. But for the most part, it's very understood that you're there to pray, and that politics and whatnot, you have to leave that at the door. You're not coming in here to negotiate things like that, and that's part of what it means to be in the state of ihram. That's also one important concept of Hajj is, and the mosque is also called the haram. These all derive from the same word, basically the root word meaning something to the effect of forbidden. And what it means is that when you're in the state of ihram, any kinds of extraneous arguments or fighting and things like that, doing any kind of harm to anybody else it's originally forbidden, but now it's especially so. And so the point is that when you're in the state of ihram, you let go any kind of argument or any kind of conflict you may be going into. You forego that because you're in a state where you have to be conscious of God at all periods of time. And so any kind of political activity or whatever, that comes second to what it is that you're doing now.
Are you was there ever a time just the mass of people made you afraid? You're afraid being in a big crowd? I mean, I often, even at a concert sometime, am worried. You know, what if a whole bunch of these people start panicking?
I had imagined that would be the case with me, just claustrophobia, yes. You know, being surrounded by sure. so many people. But when I went, I found that was not the case at all. And it may have been that, you know, there was just open access to the night sky and the stars, and you're not that close to people. So I'm not sure exactly what the reason was, but I didn't find claustrophobia to be a concern.
What's the weather like in Saudi Arabia in January?
I wouldn't know, but because when I went, it was in April. So
oh, that's right. It keeps moving.
It moves throughout the year. So
we went in January, nice. And
yeah, it's very nice. It it gets a little bit cold though at night. And one part of the Hajj, you're in Muzdalifah, where you're in an open plain and with no tent, and you have to sleep out there at night. And it got pretty cold. I think maybe 55, 60, something like that. And so. It's a little bit chilly.
Are you able to take other garments? You talked about the two required garments. Can you cover up with other things if it gets that cold?
Yes. Yeah, you can wear a blanket if you,
okay.
you put it over you if you're cold.
Does it ever rain?
Rarely, very rarely. I saw a video where it rained during one Hajj, and so I was kind of hoping it would, because when I went, it was very warm.
Uh-huh.
And so, but for the most part, the weather stayed fairly calm. There's also along the routes, the Saudi government has installed sprinklers, which also during the summer they turn on and they try to keep the air cool.
Okay.
And they're always distributing free water and things like that. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, heat, I don't think when I went was an issue. And especially now in January, I don't think it's going to be too much of an issue.
Now, when Americans travel, we're often told don't drink the water because of the bacteria that the natives are used to, but you may not be in, whether it's France or Mexico or South America or Africa or in the East. What about it on the Hajj? Do you just drink whatever the water people give you? Do you eat the food they give you, even if you wouldn't if you're ordinarily a tourist?
We had to be careful about that. Most of the time, the only water that's available to you is bottled water.
Ah.
And when you're in the mosque, Zamzam that Imad mentioned is available. And with Zamzam, you know, this is a spring that has been there since the time of Abraham. So it's miraculous in nature as it is. So with that, the only concern that we had was that we don't use a cup that somebody else has used. But the water itself that was coming out of the different coolers that they had provided, we found that to be clean, and we didn't have to worry too much about contamination of that.
And what about when you needed to find a bathroom? What do?
You know, bathrooms, they don't allow bathrooms inside the mosque itself. And this mosque is huge. I'm not sure how many feet, but it's huge. So if you had to go to the bathroom, that was a bit of a problem, because that meant that you had to trek all the way outside the mosque, you know, making way of the millions of people that are there. And then trying to come back and find the person who you have left behind.
Right.
And there's no need even trying to find the spot that you have left, because
people
it doesn't exist anymore.
Sure.
But one of the concepts that Muslims have is tahara, which is cleanliness, so that you don't find really people defecating or urinating all over the place like you would imagine at a football game or something. I mean, people do that.
Sure.
But I was really surprised at how clean it was, and mainly because of this reason. So people do hold it, and they wait, and they have a lot of patience, and they have to show patience and find a place.
Are there are there porta potties?
They're permanent bathrooms that they've set up for the Hajjis.
And we have a caller on line four, our toll-free line. Go ahead. You're on Keeping the Faith.
No.
Yes, no. Line four. Go right ahead.
Yeah.
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello?
Yes. Oops, we lost him. Well, please call back. We're eager to have you call. If others would like to call, the number is 1-800-222-9455. That may have been a cell phone. Sometimes the cell phones work fine. Sometimes they don't. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455 if you have a question or comment for our guest today, talking about the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca that all Muslims are encouraged to take at least once in their life. Are there people who go back regularly? Why would they do that?
Yes. It's sort of a spiritual cleansing. I mean, a lot of people, after they make Hajj, they feel like they miss it. And so, I mean, there is often a longing to go back. But also the fact that they have so many people going there, I think the Saudi government has imposed a limitation saying that you can't make two Hajjs within a 7-year period.
I see.
And so they try to accommodate as many new people as possible. But as far as making more Hajjs, it's if you can afford it, it's good. Mm-hmm. But often it's also more encouraged to help other people go as well.
I see.
So
we have a caller again. Maybe it's the same caller on line 4. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, go right ahead.
I have a question. My perception may be wrong, and I'm just trying to find out if it is incorrect. I'm under the impression that if you're not Muslim, you would not be welcome to that particular occurrence. Nor are you welcome to the main temple, the main church. I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, there's a reason why they don't allow non-Muslims there, and that's namely because it's also a logistical problem. One, the reason when everybody there is Muslim, they all have to stick to the same schedule, and so they know they can keep track of everybody there. However, they've had news crews and non-Muslim people go there and witness the Hajj before, but that's under strict government supervision because they want to make sure that everybody's safe and everybody's okay, nobody gets lost, things like that. So right now the logistics are difficult enough as it is with that many Muslims, but opening it up to people who aren't Muslim, who aren't actually actively participating in the rituals, it makes it a little bit more difficult, puts a little bit more strain on the resources that are there. I don't believe that there's any prohibition per se that non-Muslims can't be there, because there have been, since the time of Muhammad and since the time of Abraham, people who aren't Muslim or people who aren't faithful or people who don't believe in God living in that area and being in that area. So it's not like it's an expressly forbidden thing. But because you have 2 or 3 million people moving through that area very quickly in a short period of time, the logistics are too difficult to allow people who aren't Muslim or people who aren't there to do the rituals to actually be there.
And let me clarify that there are many mosques that are open to non-Muslims to come and visit and observe the prayers and have other events, but I can see how it makes sense for security reasons alone to protect these very holy sites, of course, from possible disruption, if nothing else.
Yes.
And I'm seeing nods. People can't hear those nods, but I'll report on them. and I always hesitate when I try to speak for a religion I don't know a great deal about. My PhD is in the study of religion, but I concentrated on my own faith tradition, which is Christianity. And so although I had introductory courses in other faiths, I know my knowledge is limited. So if I ever misspeak, please correct me. We're talking with Ahmad and Fatima Jazm and with Umair Irfan about their experiences with the Hajj, the pilgrimage they each took. Now, as a married couple, when you were there, you say about 40% of the people maybe female. Do married couples not have intimate relations during the Hajj the same way that sex isn't permitted during some of the fast times?
Yes, that's true. So during the times where you're in a haram, when the men at least are in two pieces of cloth, mm-hmm. and the women are wearing essentially what they would like, that during that time it's forbidden, and for obvious reasons, because there is no real privacy.
Sure.
And so that's one of maybe the reasons that you can look into it. And so that's one of the things that go there. But we accompany each other almost for the entire Hajj, and actually in the mosque too, we accompanied each other, walked with each other, mm-hmm. Basically throughout all of the rituals.
Yeah. We have another caller, this time on one of the local lines. Line number 1, go ahead, please.
Okay. The word itself, the Hajj, does that translate to an English-type word? And like Advent means preparation. Does the Hajj translate to some meaning in English? And then also, they mentioned a group leader. Is that something that someone helps in interpret their own experiences with, or is a pretty much a personal kind of thing? Is there a sharing of their own experience with others, or I guess what's kind of the function of the group leader?
Thank you. Appreciate the questions.
Well, Hajj is, if you want to translate it loosely, it's a pilgrimage. And so, as far as your second question was
about the group leader.
The group leader, yeah. The group leader is just something that they require to make sure that they keep track of all the people there. So one person's in charge of maybe 50 passports or more. And they want to make sure that the same people that came end up leaving and that they're okay. And that's what they do. Some of them will actually then start telling you about the different locations, historical perspectives of the different locations and what you're supposed to be doing during that time. But they all vary in their skill in doing this. But sure. We had a good experience with ours.
For each of you, what was the most important part of the Hajj for you?
For me, the Hajj symbolized what Islam means for me. It internalized what I had known and practiced for my whole life that I had been Muslim. I knew that Islam is a universal religion. I knew that there are Muslims in China and Muslims in Malaysia and Muslims in Africa, but this kind of affirmed it for me, seeing and relating to so many different types of people, millions of women who didn't know me but cared for me just because I was Muslim, just because I was there, and the essence of sisterhood and fraternity that I felt there was what helped me, just internalize the religion of Islam, and that's what I carry to this day with me. And now that I think back of the structures that are there, but more so of the people that make the structure what it is.
Just to add to that, Hajj is also, they say Hajj is Arafah, and Arafah is a location where we go to and during the ninth of Dhul-Hijjah. And that during that period of time, there's a short period of time where we pray and we ask God for forgiveness, and this is the most important time. We believe that our prayers will be answered then. And the rest of the world actually fasts during this time in solidarity. The Hajjis don't fast, but the rest of the world fasts to be with them in spirit. So this is an extremely important part. And we also believe on the Day of Judgment that all of humanity will be resurrected actually at the plains of Arafah. And it's an amazing experience. You actually feel like it's the Day of Judgment when you go there, because everybody is wearing what you essentially wear when you die, two pieces of cloth, and you're put in the grave like that. So it kind of made you think of your death and what the Day of Judgment would be like.
And Umair, what was the most important part of the Hajj for you?
Well, I grew up here in the States. I came here when I was 3, and so there aren't a whole lot of other Muslims around me. And so sometimes, occasionally, I felt like I was alone in being a Muslim. But going there, it kind of showed me that, a lot of people shared my experience. There were a lot of I met a lot of other American Muslims, too. And also the fact that there's a whole world of people that are doing the same thing that you're doing, and that there's people that believe what you believe. And that's what kind of helped me cement my faith. I mean, I went there when I was pretty young, so I guess some of the more important aspects were a little bit lost on me, but I think that was one thing that really stuck with me.
Sure. Imad, what's your background? Did you grow up Muslim?
Yes, I did. Both my parents were Muslim. My mother was American, and my father was Iraqi, and so my father came over in 62, quite a long time ago. Yes, both my parents were Muslim.
And what about you, Fatima?
Yes, both of my parents are also Muslim.
And did you grow up in this country?
I came here when I was 11. So
from where?
From India.
India.
Yes. Hmm. So I consider myself partly raised. I did middle school and high school here, so I was impacted enough by the American culture.
What are the hardest things for a Muslim to deal with in the American culture?
I think keeping your identity as a Muslim, and I don't think that is the difficult thing to do in the American culture because, you know, our culture in America is one where the individual is respected, where your identity is respected. So people can practice what they like. As Muslims, we practice Islam, and that is something that is encouraged as a personal, you know, an aspect of personality. So I didn't find that to be actually a challenge of being in a Muslim culture. Something that can be a challenge is practicing the way I dress. That was a little bit of a challenge because I wear a scarf, I cover myself fully, and that's not common, you know, in America. It's not something that is that uncommon these days because people are, you know, more and more women are starting to dress this way, in this modest way. But personally for me, that was something that was a bit of a challenge.
We're down to our last 30 seconds or so. Any advice for pilgrims who are going on the Hajj, perhaps leaving this week?
I guess maybe I will give them an advice from the Quran is you should take provisions with you, but the best of provisions is right conduct. And that's, I think, the best advice.
I want to thank our three guests in the studio today who've been talking about the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, Imad Jazm and his spouse Fatima, and Umer Irfan, who is a sophomore in biochemistry at the University of Illinois. Imad, what's your field? You're in graduate school.
In mechanical engineering.
Mechanical engineering, you said, right. And Fatima is the mother of a five-month-old child, boy or girl?
Boy.
Boy. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, I'll be privileged to be able to interview Reverend Brian Sieber talking about Japanese Pure Land Buddhism. That'll be on the 8th of January, again at 5 o'clock Central Time here on WILL AM 580. Later on in January and February, we'll be talking again about Islam and later about Judaism and Christianity. Listeners who have suggestions for programs may call me, Steve Shoemaker, at the University YMCA at 337-1500. Happy to listen to ideas for future topics and future guests. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith, and look forward to next week's program on Buddhism.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Every 60 seconds, 130 new people show up in the world's cities.
No developer's building for them. No government is investing the money in creating housing that they can afford. So they take over land and build for themselves.
I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll explore the evolving city. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
I'm Lisa Mullins. Events happening around the world can affect your job, your retirement savings, and your children's future. Americans of all political stripes say they're eager to understand our nation's changing role in world affairs, and that's where public radio excels. Every day, our international news team tracks your world. Join us on PRI's The World.
Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. on WILL Urbana.
Happy New Year to you. I'm David Heckman with your Champaign-Urbana weather forecast. Mostly cloudy today. A 30% chance of showers this afternoon, the high 50. Tonight, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely. Some patchy fog, lows in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, patchy fog in the morning with showers and thunderstorms likely. The high 50 with temperatures falling into the 40s by the afternoon. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.